Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Yaron Brook. You're listening to the Yaron Brook Show. I'm in New York today, broadcasting out of my hotel room. And yesterday, I'm on my way to the opera. And, more about the opera later when we talk about positive values. But I'm on my way to the opera, and I go out of the apartment building where I was visiting, and everything is blocked. Everything, I can't go anywhere, right? All the streets are blocked. You can't cross the street. Couldn't cross Fifth Avenue. Couldn't cross the side streets. Barriers everywhere. Cops all over the place. Not that many people on the streets, but cops everywhere. And, of course, why? Well, because the Pope is going to be driving by. And, it took quite a while of just standing there and waiting for the Pope, and I'm kind of trying to get the police to let me cross the street because I'm not really interested in standing there and watching the Pope. But they're not letting me cross. So there I am, stuck. And this whole procession comes, I don't know, 30 motorbikes and a bunch of SUVs. And then the Pope, right in between these massive SUVs, in front of him and behind him, and he is in this tiny little four-door Fiat. The Pope in America is sitting in a tiny little Fiat. Talk about anti-American. Now, I think the whole concept of a Fiat in America is an anti-American idea. Right, Fiat is this tiny little car that we used to make fun of, even back in the day in Israel, as a pretty pathetic car. I'm sure this car is fine. I'm sure this car is great. But the reason the Pope is driving in a Fiat is to make a eco statement, to make a green statement. He is not overly consuming gasoline. Anyway, they finally let me cross the street, and I'm walking towards Lincoln Center where the opera is. And stuck again. And now everything's blocked, and now there are quite a few people around. And again, the Pope is driving by. He's like circling Central Park and blocking all the traffic everywhere. And people are yelling at his passing. And, of course, all you can see when he passes is his hand waving out the window of the little Fiat, which he is driving on American streets. He won't drive in an SUV. Or in a Cadillac or Lincoln or something like that, which was a real car, a real American car. No, he's going to drive in a tiny little European car. What he should have been driving is a Volkswagen, on diesel, one of those cars that it turns out Volkswagen has been with their. Hack, they put in false software there to give false readings for the emission standards. That's what he should have been. That's what he should have been driving, a Volkswagen, a diesel-driven Volkswagen. And some of the time we'll talk about why the hell diesel cars even exist. Nobody wants to drive a diesel car, and they're filthy. They're far more polluting than a regular car, and yet 50% of all the cars now in Europe diesel cars, because that's what European governments are subsidizing, because they emit. They thought for a while, central planners at their best, they thought for a while that diesel engines were cleaner, at least with regard to CO2. But it turns out that they spit out all kinds of other stuff that is actually much, much more harmful to human health than is the CO2. And anyway, but that's a different discussion. We're talking about the Pope. The Pope in his Fiat. I just find that incredibly funny. So I actually snapped a photo. I've got a photo of the Pope's arm sticking out of the window of a Fiat driving along Fifth Avenue with Central Park in the background. Anyway, I did actually finally make it to the opera, but I decided, given how much grief the Pope gave me yesterday in trying to get to where I wanted to go, I had to do a show about him, and get some retribution. And yeah, people, there were a bunch of Hispanics on the road yelling, "Hey, Che Papa, Papa, Papa," you know, as if he is their father or something. Liran, who usually participates, I see is already on the line. We'll get to Liran in a little bit. He's actually lives in Argentina, and he says he's got some good stories about this Pope. So we're going to get to him in a little while. But I want to talk a little bit about what this Pope has been talking about really since he became Pope, and really what I consider his anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-human life agenda. And why in the sense of being anti-capitalist, anti-American, and anti-human life, I think he is far more consistent from a religious perspective. He is far more consistent with his religion than all these Catholics who try to be capitalist, and all these, you know, even evangelicals who advocate for Christianity and capitalism, for Christianity and America in its original vision. And I think those are stances that are incompatible. And I know this is incredibly controversial in the world we live in today, but I believe strongly that the whole idea of faith and the particular religion that is Christianity or the Judeo-Christian tradition or however you want to articulate it are incompatible with both capitalism and with America as a political ideal. So we're going to get into all that. So this is bound to be a pretty controversial and pretty lively show, particularly if we get some call-ins from people who disagree. So tell me, what do you think about this Pope? Call in if you have disagreements about me with regard to faith versus capitalism, faith versus America. 347-324-3075. 347-324-3075. And I think you might have to press like a 1 in order to get on the queue for a phone call. So do that, then I'll see you on my screen and I can go call you. But there you go. Somebody just pressed that 1 in order to get on the line. I'm going to get to calls in a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about what the Pope has actually said, and just some issues, that he has brought up. So, this Pope is both explicitly discussed capitalism. This Pope has explicitly discussed the motivation of capitalism, the pursuit of money. The Pope has explicitly discussed environmentalism, and particularly environmentalism in the context of capitalism, in the context of economic growth, in the context of economic development. And this Pope has explicitly discussed, particularly in his address to Congress, the American system of government. So we have a lot to talk about, and he has given us lots of content, lots of stuff to really chew on and discuss and analyze and figure out. So, you know, where to start? Well, let's start with this. It really is first big major attack on capitalism, which is a speech, I think, in Bolivia. Bolivia, right? A great place. Or was it Ecuador? Maybe it was Ecuador. Anyway, a great place to start attacking capitalism, because these are countries that desperately, desperately need capitalism. These are places that are desperately poor because of their statism, because the very foundations in statism. These are countries that are, this is a continent that is right now observing what happens when you embrace an anti-capitalist view. That is, if you embrace, if you will, socialism, and you see that in Venezuela, right? You're seeing it right next door, right in Venezuela, no questions about it. And also, it's a continent that if you go to Chile, you can see the benefits of embracing some elements of capitalism. You've got this nice contrast, right? You would think that given that you're in South America, this Pope is ultimately from Argentina, again, a place that has seen the crippling, poverty-inducing consequences of statism, of government intervention, of central planning, of fascism and socialism. And yet here he is, this Pope, giving a speech in another part of Latin America, I think it was Ecuador, and he called the unfettered pursuit of money the dung of the devil. Dung of the devil. Now, you know, we could people will argue about unfettered, what unfettered mean. But basically what he's saying is laissez-faire capitalism is the dung of the devil. Because that's what laissez-faire. Laissez-faire means unfettered, means leave us alone, unconstrained. Except, I think everybody would acknowledge it, even laissez-faire capitalism, by definition, laissez-faire capitalism is the system that protects you from really bad guys, from fraudsters and crooks and criminals and thieves and so on. But he called unfettered pursuit of money the dung of the devil. And he attacked countries that embrace capitalism, embrace the profit motive. He declared that there was a universal, undeniably necessary right to the three L's, as he called them. The three L's, a right to land, lodging, and labor. Land, lodging, and labor. You have a right to those things, right? Not a right to work hard, create these things, and keep them. Not a right to property. Not a right to action. No, a right to things. A right to land, lodging, and labor. In other words, a right to work, a right to a decent home. I guess the Republicans and Democrats share the right to lodging with them because, you know, given housing policy in the United States over the last, since the Great Depression, over the last 75 years, we seem to have embraced this idea that there's a right to housing and a right to land, which is, I guess, related to that. So every human being has a right to land, lodging, and labor. At whose expense? Oh, there is no expense. There is no expense. What are you talking about? What this Pope evades, what almost everybody evades, almost everybody, right, left, center, but certainly the left and certainly elements of the right, what they all evade is that wealth, lodging, real lodging, labor, have to be created. They're not in a state of nature. Jobs just are not there. Jobs have to be created. Who do they get created by? Well, were there jobs, in the sense that we understand it today, were there any jobs 300 years ago? No, there were not. Most of us were subsistence farmers. We didn't have anybody working for us because we couldn't afford to pay them. There was no surplus from which to pay them. We basically raised the food that we ate. There were some merchants, not many. There were some craftsmen who belonged to guilds. But there were no jobs. There were no jobs. People worked for themselves, barely survived. Life expectancy, of course, was 40 or less than 40. And, you know, life was miserable and pathetic, awful, horrific. When did jobs come into existence? Jobs, labor. Labor didn't exist until capitalism. What does capitalism mean? Capitalism is a system of government. It's a social system that protects rights. And its economic manifestation is a system where capitalists invest their money, take risks with entrepreneurs who have ideas on how to create wealth by bringing people, trees, and machines and capital together in order to invest, in order to create something that then is marketable to consumers. So the capitalist gives the money to entrepreneur, and then the entrepreneur goes and hires laborers. Laborers don't exist without the capitalist. The capitalist is what makes labor possible. There's no such thing as labor without capital. The, you know, that dung of the devil, that unfettered pursuit of money, is what makes lodging, the lodging that we have in the 21st century, the quality of lodging that we have today, and labor and wealth and fertile land and everything else that we have around us, productive land that we have around us that can yield the kind of yields that we have today, and the value that land has for real estate and for factories and for residency and so on, all of that is made possible by that dung of the devil, by the pursuit of money, by the capitalists. This is the whole thing. Marx had it all upside down. The real value created is by the capitalist and the entrepreneur. The laborers, in a sense, and I mean this just in a sense, right, not literally, are the ones exploiting the capitalist and entrepreneur. They would have nothing without the capitalist and entrepreneur. The capitalist and entrepreneur would make their very living, their very jobs, their very livelihood, their very ultimately existence possible. This earth cannot feed, cannot supply the goods for 7 billion people without capitalism. In some form, not in some form, in some quantity. What we have today are mixed economies all over the world. There's no real capitalism. But to the extent that they have economic freedom, to the extent that they allow for economic freedom, to that extent, they can feed, they can, you know, people can feed themselves, people can afford a home, people can afford land, people can afford the things that the Pope wants them to have. So this Pope is bought into completely into the Marxist, socialist, leftist view of economics. It's not really a view of economics because they don't really have or know or do economics. There's no economics there. There's no there. It's you know, at best ignorance, but in this case of this Pope, I can't believe it's ignorance. He's too intelligent. He's lived in Latin America. He knows enough history to know what periods of history have been successful, what countries have been successful, and what has been a failure. He knows this. So I don't think there's any question that this Pope is purposefully ignorant. That is, he's evading. He's turning and looking the other way. He's ignoring facts, purposefully ignoring facts, just like the left does, can't admit to themselves that their system is a failure and the capitalism, freedom, economic freedom are successes. They are evaders. So this Pope is not innocent. He's not just ignorant. And if you know anything about objectivism, if you know anything about Ayn Rand's philosophy, you know that evasion is the origin of all sin. It is the origin of evil. So it's the essence of immorality, because morality for objectivism, the essence of morality for objectivism is think. Use your mind. What these leftists, the intelligent leftists, the educated leftists, and the Pope are doing is evading reality, shutting down their minds, denying reality, an obvious reality, a reality that anybody should be able to see. And for that, I would say not only are they ignorant, not only is it stupid. Not only is it destructive, and we'll get to its destructive nature in a minute, but it's actually immoral. All right, when we get back, we are going to continue talking about the Pope, and we are going to take a phone call from Liran, who's in Argentina, who's going to give us a little bit of backstory, and I'll take some of your other calls when we're right back after these commercials.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism, and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
Hey, if any of you are in New York or in New York area this coming week, you should join us for the Atlas Shrugged dinner. It's always a fabulous time. It's expensive, so this is more to those of you who can afford to come. But I'd encourage you to visit us. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's on Tuesday night at the St. Regis. You can go to aynrand.org/NYC. AynRand.org/NYC. So join us this coming Tuesday in New York. We are talking about the Pope. I just want to bring up a couple of things. Because he was in the United States this week, he was trying to play it nice, and he didn't want to come across as too negative about about capitalism. So in a speech on Thursday here in the U.S., I think in front of Congress, he praised the spirit of enterprise, right? Why? Well, but not unequivocally, of course, the spirit of enterprise only if it serves the common good, right? So it's all about, he's all for the creation and distribution of wealth. As long as it serves what he calls the common good. And if you look at his speeches, particularly here in America, he uses the word, the term, the common good, over and over and over again. Right? In his speech to Congress, he said the common good also includes the earth. Well, now he's getting really deep, right? So the common good doesn't have a meaning. It doesn't mean anything. There is no common. Who are the common? What's good for me in this particular moment is not necessarily good for anybody else. And indeed, the way they use it, sacrificing some people for other people is fine in order to serve some intrinsic greater purpose, greater good, public interest, common good, and so on. Now, there's a reason this Pope uses the common good so much. And it's a little, because you'd expect that it would be a little surprising, isn't there, good and evil, and there's just good according to Catholicism? Well, it turns out this Pope is somewhat of a moral relativist. Now, I believe all religion in the end is moral relativism, because at the end of the day, there is no objective, not objective in the sense of reality-based standard for what is good and what is evil. So at the end of the day, it's scripture that determines what is good and what is evil. And what is scripture if not the interpretation of some subjective? There is no standard to evaluate scripture. There is no God. There is no communication with God to tell us exactly what it means, right? So what it means is left up to this subjective interpretation of whatever rabbi, whatever priest, whatever pope decides it is. So all religion ultimately boils down to a subjectivist, relativist morality. But this Pope is pretty explicit. In his speech to Congress, he basically said, you know, there is no such thing. We have to be very careful, he said, between defining things as good versus evil. Black and white, you really have to be careful in talking about these things. It's not clear that there is such a thing. So he's explicitly a moral relativist. And moral relativists, they need, moral relativists still have very strong moral opinions. This is true of all the leftists who claim to be complete subjectivists and complete moral relativists, right? They have strong moral conviction. So where does this strong moral conviction come from? Well, it comes from this notion that they basically make up, and it's still completely subjectivist and meaningless, but it sounds good, which is called the common good or the public interest, right? And that gives it some kind of, yes, this is in the common good, therefore it's good. But what is the common good? How do you define it? Who gets to decide what's in the common good? No answer. No answer. They can't answer it because there is no answer to that question. The common good is a meaningless statement. It doesn't mean anything. There is no common, there is no public, other than if you mean a collection of individuals. And then what's good for the common or what's good for the public is what's good for each and every individual. And the only thing that you can say from a political perspective is good for each and every individual is to be left alone, which means, from a political perspective, the only thing that you can say is protecting individual rights, protecting the right of each individual to act freely, free of compulsion, free of force, free of coercion, is the only thing that the common good or the public interest can actually mean in any meaningful way. But of course, that's never how they're used. They're always used in defiance of individual rights. They're always used to violate individual rights. They're always used to sacrifice the minority for some pressure group. Actually, often to sacrifice the majority for some pressure groups. The common good is just code for pressure group politics. Whoever shouts the loudest, whoever can create the most noise, and in the Pope's case, whoever, it's just an excuse to sacrifice some people for other people. And for him, The goal of sacrifice is to sacrifice for the poor. And that comes straight out of Christianity. You're supposed to sacrifice for the poor. The meek shall inherit the earth. They are the virtuous. They are the good. They are the focal point. So sacrifice as many people, sacrifice the successful, sacrifice the wealthy, sacrifice anybody for the poor. Now, of course, that doesn't help the poor. Socialism, redistribution of wealth, the welfare state never helps the poor. But he doesn't care about the poor. And this is the real deep secret. None of these people care about the poor. What they care about is inflicting pain on the successful. What they care about is the suffering and the sacrifice. That's what motivates them. That's what truly inspires them. They're not interested in helping the poor. Because if you were interested in helping the poor, and I'll make this last point and then go to some calls. If you're interested in helping the poor, if that's what really motivates you in any kind of sense, and if you understand what that means, improving their quality of life, improving their standard of living, increasing the opportunities that poor people face so that they can improve themselves, then you would be an advocate for capitalism, for unfettered capitalism, for laissez-faire capitalism, for the dung of the devil in this Pope's terminology. All right. We are going to take a call, and we're going to go to Liran, who is, I believe, calling from Argentina and has something to say about this Pope. Hi, Liran. You're on the air on the Yaron Brooks Show.
Hello, Yaron.
Hi.
So what do you want to know about the Pope? I have a few stories. I'll start with one.
Well, tell us a story. We don't have all day, but tell us something that illustrates
no, just a quick one.
Underlying philosophy, something that really captures what he's all about.
What is it all about? Well, one funny thing is that in 1986-7, I think, he wrote his papal dissertation, or the equivalent of a papal dissertation in their system, about why the church needs to make social justice as their focus. That was a long time ago, but he was that was part of his agenda even then. My favorite part was that in 2001, when there was a financial crisis, he said, and I'm quoting from Wikipedia, he said that the government's austerity with money is horrible because it increases poverty.
Yes.
This was at the time that the government here was bankrupt.
Yeah, but he's come out against austerity programs all over the world. He did the same thing in his speech in Bolivia. He said that the problem in the world, and he was referring to Greece, but he was referring to all these countries, saying the problem is these institutions, I think he's talking about the IMF and others, come into these countries and insist on austerity programs. Now, what are austerity programs? I'm not a big fan of the IMF, and much of the advice they give is horrible. But what he meant by austerity programs is the idea that governments have to live within their means, that they can't spend money they don't have. And, of course, he is vehemently against that. They should spend as much as they can because supposedly, quote, it helps the poor. Mm. But it doesn't. It does exactly the opposite. It destroys the capable poor. It destroys the ambitious poor. It destroys jobs.
I think he knows that.
What do we mean by social justice? What do you think he means by social justice?
I think he means whatever is gonna let him level out the playing field, take from some people and give it to some other people to ensure power to himself.
Really, social justice just means egalitarianism. It's an alternative.
That's
to socialism.
The intellectual part of it.
Yeah, they're after power.
Yes.
He certainly, I think, is after power, and he was a very authoritarian priest. I understand when he first took over the Jesuit mission in Argentina, he was very authoritarian, and the other priests hated him. And he was actually quite conservative in those days. And then I think he was, after 15 years of doing it, he was kind of shunned, and he was sent into exile for a couple of years to contemplate his sins.
He wasn't sent into exile. He was sent off to someplace less important.
Yes, and basically came back much kinder and nicer and much more receptive to social justice and the liberation theology. And since then has been kind of a left-wing pope, or much more of a left-wing
he's
pope.
He's known as Izquierda Católica, which means left Catholics, which was political movement with Catholic people who are usually center-rightist simply went all the way to the left and agreed completely with socialists. I mean, you know who is the Kirchners? The
sure,
ruling dynasty
sure.
now?
Sure, the ruling dynasty.
He was their rival.
Yeah, no.
He was seen as the rival, and then he made friends, and before that, he cooperated with the military dictatorship.
Yep.
So
yeah, no,
that's
this is
guy's history.
This is an incredibly corrupt individual who ultimately, like most politicians, is after power, you know, and holds vicious ideas that, as I've said, are clearly anti-ambitious, poor, anti-anybody who wants to make a better life for himself. Thanks, Yvonne. Really appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Wait, can I just tell one funny story?
One funny story. Sounds good.
All right. So there is a very famous, prominent university in Argentina, the Catholic University. And they identify as right-wing. You know, they have economists who are for the gold standard. They don't like social programs. And when he became pope, he was invited, because they have to invite him, but he was not allowed to speak.
Yeah. See, even the Catholics would like him to shut up, or some Catholics anyway. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Liron. All right, let's see. We've got another call here. And who's this? You're on the Yaron Brook Show.
Hi, Yaron. This is Joe Kellard from New York.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to draw a parallel between Pope Francis and, if you'll indulge me, a Soviet dictator, more specifically the media's general treatment of them. If you recall, after Soviet dictator Brezhnev died in 82, he was succeeded by Yuri Andropov, who I believe was in power for about 15 months before he died. With all the press surrounding the Pope's trips to Cuba and the U.S., I was reminded of a essay that Peter Schwartz wrote about him for the intellectual activists at the time. It was called The Andropov Mystique. So what's the parallel? Schwartz wrote that the press hailed Andropov, you know, as different from the Stoic Brezhnev. He was broad-minded and westernized, and he liked jazz and Sinatra and played tennis. And all this was something fundamentally important about him and evaluating him as a dictator. But Schwartz also pointed out that he was the official of the Communist Party for 30 years. He was an ambassador in Hungary when they crushed the revolution there, and he was involved with the invasion of Czechoslovakia and all these, you know, terrible things. So Schwartz points out, he pointed out that the press treats those facts as equally relevant about him. So what's the parallel with the Pope that I see, that I thought of this week? And, you know, this Pope is very popular, especially with the youth. And there's a lot of focus on things like he has his own personal Twitter account, and, you know, he takes selfies with his admirers, and he's generally regarded as the cool Pope, you know. But yet he's, as you say, he's explicitly anti-capitalist. He's a poverty worshiper. You know, he told the Cubans to love poverty like a mother. You know, meanwhile, they suffered for decades of deprivations due to the socialism that he morally supports. At least morally, and then he meets with the Castros, who have, you know, they have more than blood just on their hands, and gives them his moral sanction. And then meanwhile, he goes back to Rome to live his very un-Jesus-like life in luxury, living in a palace, you know, while the church rakes in billions of dollars. And, you know, and those billions of dollars are made possible by the very capitalism that he condemns. So I just wanted to bring up that parallel.
No, absolutely. And I think that parallel is deeper in the sense that I think that it's not just that he's cool that young people like. I think what they like is his ideology. That is, it's the same ideology as their professors have been teaching them at the university. It's the anti-capitalist, Castro, Cuba-worshipping, poverty-worshipping ideology of the American left, of the professoriate in the humanities in American universities. So these kids, instead of getting in an old, crotchety, kind of conservative-looking, conservative-speaking pope like in the past, suddenly they've got a hip, cool, relatively liberal pope who speaks their language, the language of socialism, the language of moral relativism, the language of, You know, he could teach at Harvard and Yale, and he'd fit right in with what is being taught there. So I think that these kids are being indoctrinated in the common good and the vice of capitalism and the virtues of socialism. And I think, you know, the communist dictators, even back in the 70s and 80s, were viewed as cool because they were viewed as somehow moral because, yeah, communism might not work, but it sure is a moral system. It's nice in theory, at least. Capitalism is vicious both in theory and in practice, according to these ideologies, right? Right.
There was one other thing sure. I wanted to – I agree with you. And one other thing I just wanted to point out. Now, I didn't hang on every word of the Pope during this whole trip. But as far as I know, when he was in Cuba, he had nothing to say about climate change, you know, catastrophic global warming. Yet, what was one of the first things he talked about, or maybe even the first thing he talked about when he arrived in the U.S. in D.C.? Climate change. That's sure. the first thing he talked about. But he didn't, as far as I know, he didn't talk about it in Cuba. But that's the first thing he brought up when he came here.
Well, 'cause their carbon footprint is very, very small. That's what embracing poverty and indulging poverty will get you. It's a very small carbon footprint. We have a very large carbon footprint because of capitalism, and he's realized, just as the left has realized, is that the best way to destroy capitalism is through the mythology of climate change. It is a brilliant move on the part of the left, in a sense, to make the destruction of capitalism appear to be in our self-interest. To save humanity, we must destroy capitalism so that we can minimize our carbon footprint. That is a brilliant move on the left, which the right has not really counted yet.
And I just, I know I said my last comment was my last.
This has to be the last because I need to go to commercial.
Okay, sure. You talked earlier about the Pope purposely ignoring facts. When he was at the 9/11 Memorial and World Trade Center, he said basically, you know, the murderers who took down the Twin Towers, he didn't say that. He didn't call them murderers. But he called them, you know, the prophets of destruction and death. And as far as I know, destruction and extremism aren't ideologies. It was Islam and the violent passages that are in the Quran that the, you know, 9/11 hijackers took seriously and acted on.
Absolutely.
That's the ideology.
And that evasion is not unique to the Pope. George Bush never called them Muslims. He called them once. Obama's never called them Muslims. And much of our intellectual elite in this country refuses to attribute anything that happened on 9/11 to the great religion of peace, Islam. And this is part of his moral relativism and the moral relativism of the West today. So thanks for calling. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to your Ron Brooks show. And we are going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back to talk more about the Pope and to take more of your calls.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
All right, we're back. This is the Run Book Show. And, you know, the Ayn Rand Institute's fiscal year ends October 1st, and we've got a pretty ambitious fundraising goal this year. And if you can help, we'd really appreciate it. If you value this radio show, it's made possible by people contributing money. So I'm gonna make the NPR pitch, right? If you're listening and you haven't sent something to the Ayn Rand Institute, hey, what's up with that? Value for value? You should be contributing something towards the, hopefully, value that you get from this radio show. Any amount. It could be $5, $10, $35, $1,000,000, anything in between to support this show, to support your values, to support the Ayn Rand Institute continuing to fight for the ideas that you believe in out there in the culture. Really appreciate anything you can do. You could go to the AynRand.org. Find the support button. You can make a contribution by PayPal or with a credit card, or of course you can send a check. But easiest way is just to do it online. And you know, the more you contribute, the better. The more you contribute, the more we can do. And we are talking about the Pope, and I just want to go through a little bit about what he said in Congress, because I think it's interesting. And again, I think the left has a lot to celebrate from this Pope's visit, because he's basically articulated their case. He's basically advocated for their values and done so to an audience that they really get. I mean, they've got a president who articulates this, but I think the Pope, for some bizarre reason, which we'll get to in a little while, has kind of more moral authority than Obama does. So I think he gets the new audience, and he really puts many conservatives on the defensive, because so many conservatives are religious. So what did he say to Congress? Well, one of the things he said in talking about Congress and legislation, he basically argued that the legislative activity, and I'm quoting the Pope here, legislative activity is always based on care for the people. This guy's not read our Constitution, not read the Declaration of Independence. There is no legislative activity responsible for taking care for the people. It doesn't spring, the authority doesn't come from taking care of the people, it comes from the protection of rights. It comes from the protection of individual rights and the non-violation of those rights. But again, this is consistent with the common good theme, the people, and the notion that the state, like the church, has to serve as our mother or father or leader or representative. Not in the representative in the sense of protecting us, but representative in the sense of making decisions for us. We, the people, are too ignorant and stupid and incompetent to take care of ourselves, so we need smart legislators to take care of us. Now, this is the same argument every single authoritarian in history has made. Common good, public interest, we're just here to take care of you. The Pope goes on to say, he talks about Lincoln and his legacy, and he goes on to say that Lincoln's legacy is building a future of freedom requires love of the common good and cooperation in a spirit of subsidiarity and solidarity. Wow, That is nonsense. And particularly, quoting, you know, referring to Lincoln. Lincoln's the guy who went to war, a war in which 600,000 Americans died in order to free slaves. I think a just war. But that's not solidarity and subsidiarity, and that's not cooperation. And where's the common good? Where's the good of the 600,000 who died? There's no common good there. There's good in a sense of protecting individual rights, a good that is worth fighting for. But not some utilitarian BS. It's really quite unbelievable how they use all this stuff. Referring to 9/11 and referring to the, you know, the struggle with Islamic totalitarianism, the jihadis, the Pope says, our response must instead be one of hope and healing, of peace and justice. Moral relativism and weakness and appeasement. This is the Christianity of turn the other cheek. This is what Christianity is really about. And in that sense, thank you, Pope, for putting it in the forefront. He goes on to criticize the effects of unjust structures and actions all too apparent, i.e. in the developed world, which is capitalism. And he urges us to cooperate for the common good again, again, again. All right. Well, I could go on and on. Every sentence of these speeches is horrific and depressing. And I just want to point something out. And you know what? Let's take this call, and then I'll point this out and point the horrific nature of it. And then there's a lot of other stuff we can talk about. But our boards are lit up. We might not get to drug pricing today, which I was hoping to talk about. If you're interested in hearing me talk about drug pricing, I'll probably shift that to my Chicago show, which you can hear on iHeartRadio at 5 o'clock East Coast time, 4 o'clock Central time. You can hear it on iHeartRadio on AM 560, or you can hear it on Blog Talk Radio. We'll load it up later this week, and I'll focus most of my comments on drug pricing. For that, we'll stick with the Pope, because we got a lot of people calling in, and I've still got a lot that I want to say. All right. Let's see. Who's this? You're on the Yaron Brooks Show.
Hello?
Yep. You're on there.
Oh, hi. Sorry. Hi, I'm calling from Philadelphia, actually. So
okay, what's your name?
Mark.
Mark. Hey, so the Pope is visiting you today.
Hopefully,
you're staying home.
Well, I actually ran out to get groceries. I went out of my door and I saw a bunch of soldiers.
Oh wow.
And some empty streets. So definitely feels like I'm in a militarized zone right now.
Yeah, that's scary. So what are we talking about?
But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say. You know, as much as he resembles Bernie Sanders and the Pope is and speaks the language of really the enemy of objectivism in human life, I think it's great that he, like you said, puts conservatives on the defense. I mean, some of my closest friends who are very conservative and, you know, very libertarian in their political and economic leanings are Christian. And I guess the question I wanted to ask you is it right to assess their response to this Pope in how moral they are, or how honest they are, or do you think it's kind of a benefit, giving them the benefit of the doubt is a better way of doing things?
You know, I think it's very difficult, but if somebody is incredibly intelligent and knowledgeable and a defender, you have to say at the end of the day that sticking to religion and in spite of everything and trying to combine it with capitalism and freedom, in spite of everything written in the New Testament and the Old Testament, in spite of all the evidence and all the facts and all the evidence and the facts of the harm that religion has done the world, and I'll talk more about that in a little while. I think for a lot of people, if not most people, again, of a certain intelligence, of a certain education, of a certain knowledge, evasion is involved, and evasion is morally wrong. That is, evasion is immoral. So I find it hard to believe that they can hold both at the same time. I think the Pope is worse. Pope is evading a lot more. He's evading so much of reality, the economic truth, the political truth, the fate of individual human beings, the fate of the so-called poor, and on top of that, the whole religion stuff. So he's a lot worse. But the defenders of capitalism still somehow stick to the religion. I mean, there's a real issue there, and there's a real problem. And I'm not saying stop talking to them, because I think we need to try to educate them, try to teach them, try to provoke them, try to get them thinking about these things properly. But it's not that they get them all blank check and we're gonna give them the benefit of the doubt forever. At some point, you have to question.
Do you think someone who clings to that eventually, it's a matter of time before mysticism kind of breaks down their moral foundations otherwise?
You know, I don't know. People can compartmentalize pretty amazingly, and sometimes that can last your whole life. But yeah, and there's certain issues where you might push them, right? What do they think of gay marriage? What do they think of abortion? And those are the issues that it usually breaks down. Oh, we believe in freedom everywhere except. And over time, I think it's harder and harder for them to hold the contradictions. But, you know, some people can hold them. Some people are amazing at compartmentalizing. So it's not always the case that they become socialist or something just because that's more consistent with their religion. People can hold the opposite views for a long period in their lives, which is too bad. It would be easier if they didn't, and you could see it, right? And it was evident.
Right.
All right, great.
Well,
thanks, Mike.
Thanks for my questions. I appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure. Anytime, call in. You're listening to Iran Brooks Show, and we're going to take one more call. And you're on the Iran Brooks Show. Who's this?
Yes, this is Whitaker.
Say that again. I didn't hear you. What your name was?
So it's Whitaker.
Oh, hi, Whitaker. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Ouray, Colorado.
Oh wow, from Gulch.
Well, what I think you're on, what you don't understand, and I enjoyed your show, but even Ayn Rand said that philosophy, religion is philosophy, and it's an early philosophy. And the Pope is, I mean, I know you said a lot of stuff, but basically the Pope is all about love. And love is his philosophy. And, you know, it goes back a lot longer than Ayn Rand. So why, isn't just love?
Well, what does love mean? What does love mean? What do we mean by love?
Love others.
What does that mean? What does it mean? What do we love?
The
Pope message is love. Yeah, I mean, I love love. I love the message of love, and I wish the Pope actually understood what love actually meant, because love comes from loving one's life, and it comes from loving values, and it comes from loving the good. Love is an emotion one feels towards things that one values, things that contribute to one's life. The standard for love is life. And if the Pope took love seriously, then he couldn't advocate for what he advocates for, because what he's advocating for is a philosophy, is a set of ideas that brings about misery and suffering and hardship and the lack of love, conflict, and the poor hating the rich and the rich hating the poor and those kind of divisions. That's what his ideology absolutely, ultimately has to lead to. And that's the history of religion, and that's the history of the political left. The political left has always led to strife and misery and conflict. And it's only capitalism that brings about values and love and prosperity and happiness and success. So if you really believe in love, I'm a big believer in love, then you should embrace individualism and capitalism. Capitalism is the system of love, because it's a system that represents the love of values, the love of creating those values, the love of trading those values, the love of human life. All right? So you should go out the door and look around at Uray, which is one of the most beautiful places on the planet, and have fun and enjoy yourself and love the things that make it possible for you to have a good life and prosperous life. Although I suspect you're in Chicago and not in Uray. But anyway, we should all embrace life, love life, enjoy life, and embrace the one political social system that allows us to really love. Thanks for the call. These are great. I mean, this is the most calls I've had, I think, in any show. And so keep it coming. I encourage you calling, asking questions. I'd love for more disagreement, and somebody who actually can defend the Pope would be terrific. But sorry, this Pope ain't about love, because everything he advocates is going to lead to misery. Maybe he's the Pope of misery. I think Catholicism is the religion of misery.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AynRand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
All right, so if you're enjoying the show, if you enjoy the Iran Book Show generally, you should be helping us fund this. I mean, this show is made possible from contributions, tax-deductible contributions. And you can go online and you can make a contribution, anything, $5, $10, $1,000, $5,000. This show costs money. My time is money. The Blog Talk Radio facility is money. There's a bunch of people in the background who need to be paid. You should pay up for the values that you receive. So help support us, AynRand.org. Go to the support button and drop us a credit card or PayPal or something. Anyway, I want to now talk a little bit about, in a broader sense, about why this Pope, Catholicism, but generally religion, unnecessarily, at the end of the day, in spite of everything they advocate, anti-capitalist. And I think many of the more honest Christians recognize this, and you can see this among conservatives and some libertarians. One of my favorites on the conservative side is a guy named Michael Novak, who works for the American Enterprise Institute, or at least used to. And he's a big advocate, supposedly, for capitalism. But he also recognizes that it's, at the end of the day, inconsistent with his religion. So he can't really be a strong advocate for capitalism. He always has to hold back, and hold quite a bit back. So, for example, in a speech he gave, and this is quite a long time ago, but I've seen this in some ways repeated over and over again. He spends the whole how wonderful capitalism is and how it produces the goods and creates all the goodies and raises the standard of living and the poor better off and da-da-da-da-da, all of this. And he's doing this in Asia. But then at the end of the speech, he says, look, but there's a problem with capitalism. It's not moral. It's not ethical. So while some people give capitalism three cheers, I can't do that. And some of my friends give capitalism, Irvin Kristol in particular, give capitalism two cheers. I can't even give that. I give capitalism one cheer. So this is the most the Catholic can do at the end of the day, is give capitalism one cheer. Why? Why? Because capitalism is a system of self-interest. Capitalism is about the profit motive. And self-interest is anti-Catholic. Self-interest is anti-religion, almost any religion. At the end of the day, your life does not belong to you. At the end of the day, action should not be focused on making your life the best that it can be. At the end of the day, what drives you is not love for yourself, which then makes possible love for other people. Remember Ayn Rand's statement, before you can say, I love you, you have to first be able to say the word I. No, religion is about self-abrogation. It's about self-denial. It's about a higher authority. It's about loving God and attaining all values through the love of God. That is the primary in morality. And what does God demand of us primarily? To sacrifice for our neighbors, to love our neighbors, to love our neighbor as ourselves. Now, I know Christians jump up and say, yeah, but you have to love yourself first. But that's ridiculous. So they say, you know, just like in the airplane, right, when they give the announcements, they say put on your oxygen mask first so that you can then help your neighbor. But no, I put on my mask first because I'm trying to save my life. And then I might help my neighbor, but I'm not going to put on my mask so I can help my neighbor. The purpose is not to help my neighbor. So, yeah, I need to love myself, not for the purpose of loving my neighbor, and I don't love myself like my neighbor. Be honest, guys. If you have any ounce of self-esteem, you love yourself more than you love your neighbor. This is the test. This is the test, right? Your neighbor's child is drowning, and your child is drowning. Who do you save first? Well, you save your child first. And you should be proud of that choice, not embarrassed by that. You should be proud of the fact that you value what is yours more than you value what is not yours, because you value your life more than you value other people's lives. And that is so, at the end of the day, so anti-Catholic, so anti-religion. Religion is about, it's a primitive philosophy, but it's a primitive philosophy with some pretty bad premises. And the fundamental premise is your life belongs to God. The standard is God. The standard is otherism, which is altruism. And God tells you, what you should sacrifice for and the common good, right? The Pope has told us that's what we should sacrifice for. It's just another leftist altruistic ideology. So that's at one level. Of course, that leads to collectivism, which all religion advocates for at the end of the day, because it can't advocate for individualism, because individualism is based on the idea that your life is yours. It's very rare in history that you can combine individualism and some religion. The founding fathers are rare. John Locke is rare. But the founding fathers and John Locke were not religious in the sense that people are religious today. They were far, far, far more secular. They took religion far, far less seriously than the Pope or than evangelicals do in the United States today. It is a travesty that the founding fathers today are considered religion's guiding lights, that they were guided by religion, and the notion that America was founded on principles of Judeo-Christian principles is absurd and ridiculous, and yet so common. Because if you really studied the founders, if you really listened to what they said, if you look at what they said, they were profoundly secular. I'm not saying they were atheists, but they were secular. They believed in a God. Most of them did. I don't think all of them did. They believed in a God, but they put him aside. He had his role, right? It wasn't central. And at the end of the day, bring even the existence of God before reason. That's Thomas Jefferson, right? So everything is subordinate to reason. Now notice, this is really the core, the essence of what makes religion anti-capitalist. Capitalism is the system that liberates reason. Capitalism's the system of reason, of human reason, of human thought, of rationality. Capitalism is a consequence of the Enlightenment. What's another name for the Enlightenment? The Age of Reason. It's a consequence of the idea that we, human beings, have this capacity to know and understand the world, and that we can manipulate the environment using our reason to make our life better. And an understanding, which the Enlightenment had, that reason, to be successful, that is to produce these results, needs to be left free. It's the understanding, the profound understanding of the role of reason in human life. And then an understanding that that demands freedom, which makes America possible, which leads to the establishment of America, and that ultimately makes the Industrial Revolution and capitalism possible. It's that profound respect for science that comes out of the Enlightenment. Why they respect science? Because they respect reason. Science is an illustration of reason's efficacy. We can explain the world. We don't need mystical revelation. We don't need God. We don't need this primitive philosophy of religion, of Catholicism, of Protestantism, or whatever the religion is. We know, we can know reality. We can change reality in the sense of changing the world around us to fit our needs as human beings, because we have this amazing capacity to understand reality, observe reality, figure out causality, and then figure out how to manipulate the elements within the physical world to change them. So capitalism is the system of reason. It's the system of rational thought. And what are the two elements? What are the two things that are most opposed to reason? Faith is the spiritual opposition, and force is the existential opposition, the opposition in the material world, right? And what does religion represent? Faith and force. There's no reason. I mean, there's a certain respect for reason in post-Aquinas in the Catholic Church, but only to a point. And at that point, faith takes over. And if faith is advocating for a position that's opposite of reason, then faith wins out. And how does faith win out? By using force. You burn at the stake. You put Galileo under house arrest. You deny evolution. And you know, if these deniers of evolution were given political power, real political power, would they not burn some Darwinists at the stake? Really? Do you really believe that? We use force to stop abortions. We use force to stop stem cell research. We use force because our faith tells us so. Not reason, faith. Capitalism relies on entrepreneurs using their mind. But faith and religion teaches us that at the end, your mind is not the final authority. Your mind is not a guarantee for the truth. The truth comes from revelation. The truth comes from consulting a pope, a priest. That's where truth comes from. But the marketplace, no. In the marketplace, we believe that truth comes from the market, right? In a sense of produce a product. And as long as you're not violating rights, as long as you're not violating somebody's individual rights, capitalism says, go for it. Put up your best reasoning against your competitor's best reasoning. This is a competition of thought based on reality. You can't hold that and hold religion at the same time. Because your mind is not the final authority in religion. God is. And who is God? Well, God is whoever somebody decides he is. Since there is no God, it's just the subjective preference of the existing pope or the existing preacher. This is why they all disagree. This is why they all hate each other. And this is why, when given political power, they all kill each other. Because there is no objective standard for what God stands for, what he represents, what is right and what is wrong. Each one of us has a different conception of God because there is no reality to separate it out. It's just some book that's written, which nobody can interpret anyway. So all religion can lead to is to war, is to hatred, is to conflict. It is capitalism that leads to peace, prosperity, love. The most prosperous and peaceful eras in human existence have been those where capitalism, to some degree or another, have been embraced. Even the last 70 years. Last 70 years have seen a dramatic decline in violence. Dramatic decline since World War II. If you look at every statistic on violence, and if you look at the world generally, not the decline of capitalism in America or in Europe, but the world generally, this has been an era, the last 70 years, of embracing, of moving towards, more and more and more, towards greater freedom and more capitalism. 1 billion people have come out of poverty over the last 30 years because of China and India and other Southeast Asian countries embracing elements of capitalism. Even in Africa, countries that embrace elements of capitalism, people are coming out of poverty. And I don't say why even any place, any people who embrace capitalism do well. It leads to prosperity and peace and love. And yet, religious leaders, that's not good enough for them. Because they want sacrifice. They want obedience. That's the other element that is incompatible. Capitalism is about independent judgment. It's anti-authoritarian. Capitalism is about individuals making their own decisions about what to produce, what to consume, how much, when, how much debt to take on, not to take on debt, invest in the stock market, not invest in the stock market. It's unbelievably anti-authoritarian. It says your life is your responsibility. You, nobody's going to take care of you. It's the exact opposite of the Pope, right? The role of government is not to take care of you, just to protect you from crooks and cheats and frauds. But other than that, leave you alone. It's about personal responsibility in the deep sense, not in the superficial conservative sense. There's no authority. You're on your own. Wow, scary. But that's the exact opposite of what faith demands. Faith demands that you abide by authority. Again, the authority of the priests, of the Pope, of God, of some scripture written thousands of years ago. Whatever it is, somebody else's authority. You cannot reason and discover the truth for yourself. We need to do it for you. We, the authorities, the Pope, the elite. It's no accident that one of the Pope's advisors right now is, what's her name? Her name's Klein, and she's Naomi Klein. And she's a rabid leftist, rabid hater of capitalism, rabid hater of individualism, rabid hater of reason. Reason is the enemy. The left and religion uniting. There's nothing more dangerous than that. There's nothing more scary than that. I gave a talk a few years ago. You can find it at the Ayn Rand bookstore. You might even find it online for free. On the great dangers that face us in the future. And I said the biggest danger that we face, the biggest danger that the free world faces, the biggest danger that capitalism faces, is when the environmentalist movement and when religion unite. When environmentalism and religion unite. When the left gets the moral backbone of religion with all the authoritarianism of a pope. Beware. And here we have it. We have it in this pope. You're seeing it in the evangelical movement that is moving to the left on environmental issues. All right. So religion, incompatible with capitalism. I'm sure this is a theme we'll come back to in future shows. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to talk about the opera.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be surprised supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
So I'm a huge fan of the opera. I love opera. To me, it really represents what human beings are capable of in terms of expression of emotion. You know, the range, the ability of these singers to express their passions, their fears, their love more than anything else in their voices. The beauty and romance of the music is just so sweeping, so all-embracing, so fantastic. If you love life, you got to try at least to experience opera, to experience, I think, one of the most life-affirming, love-affirming art experiences one could have. So last night, I was at the Metropolitan Opera to see Il Trovatore, which is by Verdi. Verdi is my favorite opera composer. That wouldn't be a surprise, but I love a lot, you know. There's Donizetti and there's Puccini, and I even like Wagner's operas. Drama, I mean, the drama of Wagner is amazing. But the drama, the love, the passion, the going all out, not leaving anything on the table, right? Going all for something you believe in. That's what these operas are about. Now, the stories are often stupid. Really, really. Il Trovatore, which I saw last night, is particularly dumb. But it's one of the greatest operas ever written. The music is so amazing. The singing is so stunning and passionate. And all the characters are fighting for things they believe in, even if what they believe in is really dumb, even if they're evil. They're going all out for it. It's like a Victor Hugo novel. You sometimes want to smack the heroes and say, this is stupid, stop fighting for this. But you got to admire them for putting it all out there, for following their passions. You know, if we had more objectivists, for more devotees of Ayn Rand who really believed in this and really were willing to fight for it, like these characters are willing to fight for their loves, you know, we could change the world. We could change the world. So I love experiencing that, living in a universe for a few hours where people are going all out for what they believe in and expressing it in the most beautiful, sumptuous, romantic, and dramatic way. I'm not going to go through the story of Trovatore because it's just too dumb. But the number of arias that you want to hum along with the singing, that you walk out of the theater with the music in your mind that you can't let go of because it's so engaging and stimulating. One of my favorite operas, but you know, there's so many of them by Verdi. If you're new to opera, I would definitely start off by just listening to some highlights, reels of just some put some music in the background and get used to the range, the emotion, the type of music, because it's so foreign. I mean, compare this to, I don't know, hip hop, right? I mean, it's like heaven and hell. That's I would illustrate it. Opera being heaven, hip hop being hell. I mean, the one is complete naturalism. It's the human voice. There's no real singing going on. It's gross. It's demeaning. The language is as compared to opera, which is trying to elevate the human spirit. It's trying to raise itself above the day-to-day existence. It's trying to portray the world, what is possible in the world. Right. This is what real art is supposed to do. Life as it could and it should and could be. As Aristotle said, that's what opera does. Again, not in the specific values, but in the sentiment, in the type of world it creates, and in the seriousness. This is the key. The seriousness in which the heroes take their values. And an art form that can convey this in such a dramatic, beautiful, stunning way. All right, go listen to an opera. Go pick up a record, put in a CD. You can go to YouTube. You can find a lot of stuff for free. Just try it out. And don't get discouraged. It takes time to adopt something new. It takes time to get used to a different sound, a different approach. It doesn't just come. It's not. You're not used to it. You haven't been trained by it. And our culture today trains you for the opposite. It trains you to disvalue. Start training yourself to really, really value life, value love, value beauty. This is the Iran Brooks Show. Look forward to talking to you every Saturday at 11:30 Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll talk to you all next week. For those of you who called in and I didn't get to take your call, listen again next week. I promise to take your call then. Talk to you next Saturday. Farewell from Iran Brooks.